opening up the Health, Energy, and Environment Committee. And this is February 5th. First, we are doing a work session of an organizational. Okay. Open up an organizational meeting, the committee, for adoption of the committee rules. Should all have the rules in front of you, Beth? Do you want to just make a few comments?
No, there's a standard model rules for the committee. It's a special session.
Madam Chair, I move adoption of the committee rules.
Hey, Representative Cannon moves adoption of the committee rules. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Seth.
It's very good seeing you. Unfortunately, I will be voting no on the rules for the House Committee on Energy and Environment. I have concern over point number 13 regarding the minority's ability to file a minority report. And so I respectfully will be voting no.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll ditto my colleague, Representative Smith's comments about item 13. Also, I have a question about item 14, proposed amendments by other than members. Are we going to be allowed, unlike the House rule for this session, where individuals could not have bills drafted, will we be able to have amendments drafted as individual members, or does that have to come through the committee chair?
No, you may.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Byrne.
Joining my fellow colleagues, I'm voting no because of item 13.
Okay. All right, there's a motion on the table to adopt the rules in the roll call. And the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Fire.
Aye.
Representative Gerard.
No.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
No.
Vice Chair Burley.
No.
Vice Chair Cannon.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. The House, the rules for House Committee on Energy and Environment are adopted. Okay, now I'm going to open up an informational meeting. I'm actually going to switch the agenda around just a little bit here and have Tim Lloyd come up and give us an update on land acquisition local government grant program. By the way, you really don't bite. I noticed there's only one person sitting in the front row. You're welcome to move up. I feel like we are, I know that everyone's happy about being here for special session, but you're welcome to move up.
Some of us do bite, Madam Chair.
I guess I shouldn't have spoken for all my committee members. Most of us don't bite.
This room is so large and overwhelming. It's...
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tim Wood, the Director of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and Chair Dingfelder has asked me to provide a little information briefing on the implementation or the execution of two of our budget programs this year, the Local Government Grant Program and our Land Acquisition Program. With regard to the Land Acquisition Program, the majority of our state park system was acquired prior to 1980 when the department was a part of the State Highway Department. During that time, our department was principally funded by a gas tax, and there was a lot of significant amount of federal money available to acquire properties. From 1980 to 1998, the department relied primarily on land exchanges and donations and revenue from the sale of surplus lands to expand the state park system. With the passage of ballot measure 66 in 1998, which earmarked and dedicated lottery funds to the department, that really was the first opportunity for us to appreciably grow the park system and to begin to look at meeting current and future demands. Initially, the legislature approved $4 million. That was in the 99-01 biennium for land acquisition. And subsequent biennium up to 2005-2007, that amount had increased to $7.5 million. Between 98 and 2007, we used combinations of lottery funds, donations, trades, and other means to acquire about 99 properties and about 8,610 acres. Our current budget in this biennium includes $22 million for acquisition of new properties. Our acquisition program is one of where we deal with willing sellers and to acquire properties. In December of 2007, we submitted a report of our land acquisition activities to the Joint Ways and Means Committee, and we've included a copy of that report. So this provides sort of the details of where we are. To date, you'll see in the report that Our commission has approved the acquisition of 1,953 acres at a cost of just over $13 million, and we've also targeted 19 other sites that we're looking at right now, totaling about 2,000 acres. So discussions with landowners are in progress on these additional parcels. Whether we're successful in bringing these acquisitions to completion will depend upon further negotiations, but we're dealing, again, as I said, with willing sellers, and generally we're on target to complete our acquisition program, or the funds that currently we're on target to expend the funds that have been provided to us in this biennium's acquisition program. The local government grant program is another program that our department administers. The local government grant program is used by local communities for acquiring, developing, rehabbing local parks, trails, and open spaces. It's also funded by Measure 66 funds that come through the lottery. We and our project sponsors believe that these programs are major contributors to the quality of life in the communities throughout Oregon. We kind of have a history of administering grant programs to local communities because the department has also been responsible for administration of the Federal Land and Water Conservation Program, which began back in 1964. Over time, the funds available in the Land and Water Conservation Program have varied. This year, in federal fiscal year 2008, the funds available were down to $415,000. In a couple of the previous biennials, it was like $1.2 million in each federal fiscal year. So we distribute these funds on a competitive basis to communities who apply for these grants. We also provide a grant program federally funded called the Recreation Trails Program, funded by the Federal Highway Administration, and we administer as well the RV County Opportunity Grant Program, which is funded by registration fees for recreational vehicles. But by and large, the local government grant program, since its inception back in 1999, is clearly where the most available funding has been for use by local communities. So we award grants through this program to cities, counties, park and recreation districts, port districts, metropolitan service districts, for outdoor park and recreation areas and facilities, for land acquisition, for major rehab projects, for trails, non-motorized water-based recreation. And a large variety of these kinds of programs have been funded over the years, which included acquiring property, conservation and restoration of natural areas, the development of trails and bridges, picnic areas, soccer fields, ball fields, outdoor basketball fields, golfing facilities, skateboard and bicycle parks, town squares, open areas, playgrounds, tennis courts, swimming pools, trailheads, wildlife viewing areas, urban buffer zones, and all the sort of needed support facilities to make and parking areas to make these areas available to the public. Now, the local grant program also requires matching portion from the project sponsor, and that can be cash, that can be in-kind work, that can be materials as well. So in 1991, with the beginning availability of Measure 66 dollars, the local grant program started at $4.4 million, has increased in subsequent biennia to a total of $15.7 million available to local communities in this biennia. One of the recent things that we did, since there was a large increase in the amount of money available in 2007-2009, we went back out to our project sponsors and to the public and did a review of the rules we've imposed to manage this program, with the idea to see what we could do to make the funds more available and more accessible to local communities. And as a result of that, we have made some adjustments to the program, hopefully to make it more valuable to the local communities. We are just about to implement the rules that will increase the maximum grant award from $500,000 to $750,000, and for land acquisitions from $500,000 to $1 million. We reduced the amount of match required for smaller communities from 40% to 20%, so that smaller communities who have less resources available are more capable of taking advantage of the program. And we expanded some of the project categories to include planning and feasibility studies, and also make projects easier to fund, such as bicycle recreation trails and greenway projects. some of the ideas that weren't supported in this grant rule change was providing funding for indoor facilities, for bicycle trails on transportation routes, and projects on school property. So those weren't included in the rules that were adopted. So we think that the project, this program has really done a good job of reaching communities all across the state, and I think that's illustrated by the map that I've provided. You can see where we've provided, by the end of this biennium, probably about $45 million in funding in communities across the state. So if you figure there's about a 50% match to that, that's probably an $85 to $90 million investment in parks, recreation facilities, and community improvements across the state. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Wood. I think Representative Ward has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tim, has State Parks awarded any grant funds for land acquisition to a member of the tribes in the state of Oregon?
Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, I don't believe we have.
Thank you.
Questions?
I'm sure. Tim, good to see you, and the grant program is very, very nice program. I really appreciate it. I know it's been very helpful to the Bend Metro Park and Recreation District from time to time. Would you please refresh our memory, mine particularly, and actually mine may be the only one that needs refreshing, but during the budget process last year, there was some question about the balance between the acquisition dollars and the maintenance backlog dollars, and frankly, I don't recall exactly how we resolved that. Would you please refresh my memory on that and just briefly touch on how is the maintenance going? How's the backlog on that going?
Sure. Representative Chair Dinfeld and Representative Burley, we have about, I believe, if I recall the numbers correctly, about $13 million in our facility investment program specifically for the reduction of backlog. And then there's some additional money, about $8 million approximately, in new park development. So that's all sort of facility-related. And our budget request for the agency's governor's budget request for the acquisition program was, I believe, $11 million. And what was authorized was $22. And I believe our request for the local grant program was $12 million, I believe, is what our agency request was, and then the program is at $15.7 million. So that's kind of, I think there was some interest among members of the committee that that the acquisition program in previous biennium had sort of not benefited as greatly as the facility investment program, and that was the discussion that led to the increase in the acquisition program and some adjustments to the local grant program as well. As far as backlog reduction goes, I think we're doing real well. We started in 9901 with approximately $120 million in backlog, and we've been investing in reducing the backlog in those projects, and we're down to probably 40-some million now. And we have a six-year plan, which is basically the life of Measure 66 right now. That should pretty much keep us on track. Assuming we get the funding we asked for, that we'll have that down to near zero.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's what I recall from the discussions last session. And just for clarification, the backlog, since the Measure 66 money, there's both capital and maintenance, you don't have the same constraints that OWIP does, is that correct?
Chair Dinkfelder, no. I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
Well, for OWIB, there's a certain split between capital and maintenance and non-capital. So you don't have that same constraint.
Chair Dinkfelder, no, we don't. Other than we've designed in our program a certain amount of money for park improvements, as well as some of its new park development and for backlog. But there's no statutory constraint in that.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I recognize this isn't a Ways and Means hearing, and you're here to talk primarily about land acquisition, but I wonder, once we've acquired the land, to what extent the department depends on fees generated by the users who use that land to sort of pay for the ongoing maintenance versus other sources of support.
Sure. Chair Dinkfelder, Representative Cannon. If I believe our budget in this biennium is about 44% lottery funds and about 46% other funds. And other funds are our camping fees, day use fees that we use basically to fund the operation of the system. We don't generate as much revenue in fees as we have in cost to maintain those properties. So part of the cost of maintaining properties is supplemented with that proportion of the lottery funding.
I guess, nevertheless, it is the case that, you know, that as we acquire more parks, typically these parks are supported in large part. The ongoing maintenance, upkeep of the parks is supported in large part from user fees.
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Cannon, that's true to the degree that parcels that we're acquiring actually will be developed that would have campgrounds and sort of fee generation opportunities to them.
And Representative Cannon's point is well taken. This is not the Ways and Means Committee. However, because for those folks who remember when Measure 66 was passed, the budget for state parks changed in that there is currently no general fund money going into state parks budgets. So it is completely reliant on fees and Measure 66 money. In 2014, when Measure 66 goes away, and certainly some of us in this room hope it'll be reauthorized, we have lots of discussions in Ways and Means about making sure that Parks has the resources to continue the good work that you've been doing. And certainly, if that Measure 66 money went away, then we'd be very concerned about how you continue to pay for maintenance and reducing backlog, which hopefully we won't have a backlog by then. But with new park acquisition, obviously, we have to think about how we're going to maintain the expansion of our park system. So that's really good point. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Wood, I just want to send a public acknowledgement of the great work that your department is doing and the staff you have working. Colleagues out in our area, state parks and recreation have done a fabulous job of getting out and reaching out into these remote communities, letting folks know about the local government grant program, making the process simple, putting it into English. And I just compliment you and send accolades to you and to your staff. The gentleman behind you is just absolutely fabulous in reaching out to rural Oregon, and we truly thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Brown, I think, has a follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That just triggered another question I had, Tim, and that is the Mount Emily property out near LeGrand. I know there was some interest in trying to use ATV dollars to acquire that. What's the status of that transaction?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Burley, there are a lot of conversations kind of regenerated in the community about how they might put together a project out there. I mean, this is recent, like within the last few weeks. And we've been in touch with some of the local folks about how potentially the local government grant program as well as the ATV grant program could make a contribution to a project. It would all sort of depend on how they put it together. But we are pretty much in continuing contact with folks out there.
Okay, thanks.
I would just add, Madam Chair, there's a player at the table, and there's multiple players at that table.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Wood, for providing that update. I anticipate that we may be having you come back later in the year to give us another update, but certainly appreciate the work you're doing. And I still need to get out to the newest park. I haven't been there yet, so I hope to do that maybe after session.
Great. I'd be happy to take you on a tour.
Great. Thank you all.
Thanks.
And with that, we're going to close the informational meeting. And I'm curious, is the new park, Representative Reed, is that in your district?
It is not, Madam Chair, but it's, I believe, in the adjoining district, so perhaps we can go together.
It's in Washington County, by the way. I think it's the only state park in Washington County, if I recall. Okay, next, actually, we have, I think what I'm going to do is switch around the order since we have the sponsor of House Bill 3612 here, Representative Witt, and don't want to keep him longer than we have to. So what I'm going to do now is open up a public hearing on House Bill 3612. Yeah, what happens when you get up? Mm-hmm. And Beth, could you give us a brief overview, please?
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 3612 is the legislation that addresses energy reductions by state agencies. It requires that agencies reduce their energy usage by 20% by June 30th, 2015. There is a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means on the bill. We have a notice of no revenue impact and have not received a fiscal impact yet.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wood, thanks for taking time out of your busy day to be here with us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Brad Witt from House District 31, otherwise known as the River District, stretching from Sobeys Island down to Astoria. I also represent the community of Vernonia and lots of mountains and trees in between. I want to thank you very much for hearing House Bill 3612, otherwise sometimes known as the Apollo Bill. Our state's public policy currently is that during the construction or renovation of state-owned or leased buildings that all reasonable and cost-effective energy conservation methods must be utilized in that construction or renovation. This bill goes further and says that in the instances of construction or renovation, the state agency that has controlled that building is obligated to reduce its energy usage across that agency by at least 20% by the year 2015 from the amount of energy that that agency used in the year 2000. The bill requires a plan for meeting these reductions, as well as the pre-qualifications by the Department of Energy for prospective bidders who may engage in potential energy reductions through audits, control systems, various maintenance procedures, energy savings performance contracts, and the like. The bill also would authorize the recovery of administrative costs to carry this this function out. With that, Madam Chair, I would just close by saying that this bill will save energy. It will reduce the carbon footprint that our state emits. It will save the taxpayers a considerable sum of money. And perhaps my favorite, it will help to save us the importation of foreign carbon-based fuels. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Wett, and thank you for bringing in this bill again. I do remember that we voted on it last time, and we voted it out of this committee last time, so we have another opportunity here today. Are there any questions, Representative Wett? Representative Smith?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Representative. It's very good seeing you. Can you turn to page 2, line number 19? I just want to make sure I'm interpreting number 8 correctly. This section does not apply to local government. We're just talking state. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I'm understanding the facility to mean, in essence, a building owned or controlled by a state agency.
By a state, not local government.
That is my understanding. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Madam
and
Chair.
Just to follow up, that was my understanding in it. If you look at the under Section 2, Sub 2, Authorized State Agency, it means a state agency, board, commission, department. I mean, it specifies state agency, not local.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Berlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 3, lines 25 through 27, seems to me, because somebody asked me, would this require a state agency to go back and retrofit a building And my answer at the time was no, but now that I read this, I'm thinking it really doesn't direct the agencies to do it, whether it's construction, renovation, retrofitting, whatever. What it's doing is it says you shall reduce the energy by 20%. And the more I read this, in fact, it says that the agency shall reduce the amount of energy authorized, the amount of energy in a facility. So the question is, does that mean that every existing building they have to go back and remodel, retrofit, do whatever they have to do to reduce the energy 20%, and the 20% reduction has to be in each individual facility? It can't be collectively for the whole department, for example.
And Representative Burley, we have Betty Merrill from Oregon Department of Energy, and I'd like to ask Betty to come up here because she was going to explain that.
Okay.
And so why don't you come up, Betty? And I think I know the answer, but it would probably be better if you explained it, since you're the expert. And for the record, just please make sure and state your name.
Chair Jen Fogle, members of the committee, my name is Betty Merrill from the Oregon Department of Energy. There have been a number of questions on the section with facility. The intent in the bill was not to direct them facility by facility. Bob Simonton from OUS will come up and talk about that. One of the reasons we included in this bill the Department of Energy would establish a rule for the baseline was to go back and adjust the original baseline data we collected in 2000 for the number of buildings or the square footage or the number of occupants. So that was the intent. So we're working with the agencies to come up with a better definition.
Okay, great. Good. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. And I think Representative Smith has another question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So has this bill been vetted through GASA's facility managers to find out what the potential fiscal is going to be on this? And I know this isn't Ways and Means, but that is a significant question to know what DASA's position on this legislation is.
Chair Dingfold, Representative Smith, we are working with the state agencies. In fact, we have a meeting tomorrow at 7:15 a.m. to go over issues with DAS and the other agencies. We worked through these issues last session under House Bill 2876, and we will work with them again to go through. There were a few changes made in the bill this time.
Follow-up. I heard your earlier comments, but I'm curious, is there a way for this committee to find out how many facilities will be impacted as a result of this legislation?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, yes, there will. Currently, the Department of Energy provides a biennial report on the State Energy Efficient Design Program to the legislature. In regular sessions. We did that last session. We collect data by agency currently. So if the agency weren't meeting the 20%, this plan that they'll develop in 2010, they have to look at individual facilities to determine which ones are sort of the energy hogs. So if they aren't meeting the 20%, then they'll go back and look at their facilities, but the reporting requirement is not by facility. And yes, we will have a number of buildings.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Yeah, and it may be for Betty and not Representative, but you're welcome to stay up there if you would like.
Sure.
Okay. Representative Cannon.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I have questions, and again, I'm not sure if this is best addressed to Betty or to someone else.
I'll give it a try, and maybe Representative Whitwell will want to answer
this. It's related to Section 8 of the bill. There's a sort of lays out how someone would pre-qualify, and states that the Department of Energy shall require mandatory pre-qualification as a condition for someone to submit a bid to do the energy analysis. I think it's also, if you look at Section 3, it's also possible for a professional engineer or licensed architect to do it. What's the purpose of this Section 8 limiting the folks who are qualified to do the work related to this bill?
Whoever would like to answer.
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, I'm not sure I'm understanding your question. I guess I missed your point.
What I think he's asking is about pre-qualification on line 3, page 4. which is the Department of Energy, by rule, will require mandatory pre-qualification in order to even submit a bid. So it's basically the contractor that's been approved by Department of Energy. Is that correct, Betty?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, the purpose of this section was that the Oregon Department of Energy, this bill directs us to establish a list of energy savings performance contracting firms. Those firms will be pre-qualified by the agency. It does not mandate that you use energy savings performance contracting. Currently, the department has a list of qualified auditors. We have a list of qualified commissioning agents. A qualified energy analysis does a more complicated analysis. That would require this. If you're an energy savings performance contractor, you would be required to be qualified by the Department of Energy.
Madam Chair, I guess I'm just, I haven't certainly looked at nearly as many bills as some people at this dais, but I'm interested in sort of why we would require and whether it's customary to sort of set up this sort of standard where the department establishes a list and then needs to choose from the list, and whether it's conventional for that to be directed by statute, or whether there was some particular reason in the case of energy analysis, I mean, as opposed to other types of contracting work that the state does.
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, the reason the agency, we were asked to develop this list is because energy savings performance contracting is a complicated procurement process. And the way the state has currently set up the system, working with the Department of Energy, working with Department of Administrative Services, Oregon State University and the Department of Justice to set up this contracting vehicle, is it's really three sets of contracts in one, so that it's a qualifications-based process. You hire a firm that does the energy analysis portion and identifies the measures, does a study that shows what the payback is, all those. If you agree with that analysis, you sign the second set of documents, which goes into the design process where the final costs of the project are firmed up. And then the third contract is for the actual build. So this is a little different. It's a very complicated process, and for agencies to have to go through who has the talent to be able to do this whole energy analysis piece, it is very difficult for them to do. So by setting up this procurement, it facilitates that process.
And just to follow up to that, so you're saving the agencies actually, one, from doing that, having to do that work individually, agency by agency, and obviously they don't have to have a procurement person then who has to do that. You're doing it all through the Department of Energy, and they have a list that they can choose from. Is that correct?
And Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, presumably there is an estimate of how much energy will be saved, and certainly we want to make sure that when an agency would move ahead on a project with good reason to believe that it's saving X percentage of energy, that we have professionals that are adequately trained to be able to make those kinds of guarantees.
Thank you.
Representative Garrard has asked the question yet, so go around to the side of the dais.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brad, on that same page 4, on line 19, there's just a line in there I don't think I've ever seen before in a bill. It says the director of the State Department of Energy may take any action before the operative date set forth to complete his obligations as assigned by the amendments and sections of this act. May take any action. Could you explain why that's in there? That's kind of scary, you know.
Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, I'm not the drafter of the bill, so I'm not going to take credit for putting in any action, but your point is very well taken, so thank you, sir.
that if you recall, I'm just trying to think from last session, it's just like deja vu all over again. Yeah.
I'm looking at the old bill.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if this was added by legislative council, and we may need to get them in here and ask them why. Because I don't recall that being in the bill last time.
Madam Chair, if I could comment.
Yeah. Representative Cannon.
Madam Chair, looking back at 2876, I do not see it in the bill.
No. Okay. Well, we'll make sure legislative council's here. We'll clarify that. You know, you got to watch legislative council when they flip these things in. And they usually have a good reason for it, but we need to find out why on that account. Did you have a comment on that?
I had a question and a comment. Did you recognize me?
I recognize you.
Oh, I thought I heard you call Representative Cannon.
No, I'm sorry.
That's
I thought
quite
it was
all right.
Early. So.
That's quite all right. Yeah. Just real quickly to follow up on that, that is a very good question. I especially in light of the fact that Section 5 is an emergency clause, so it would be interesting to get LC's comments. But I wanted to go back to the Q&A Representative Cannon started about this pre-qualification stuff, because this bill now has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is it primarily due to additional FTEs that would be required for this pre-qualification process? Why all of a sudden Ways and Means referral?
Chairman Dinkfelder, Representative Billy, the bill went to Ways and Means last session. I believe it's related to the FTE attached by my agency through the SEED program, the State Energy Efficient Design Program. There are two components. There's the new building or major renovation component, and there's what we call the conservation initiative, which is the energy savings in existing buildings. Under the State Energy Efficient Design Program, the Oregon Department of Energy it's a fee-based program, so agencies are paying a percentage of the project, and we build them out for hours that staff actually works. So fundamentally, we recoup our costs through the agencies.
Okay.
So fundamentally, the FTE is from our agency to work with more of these projects. As agencies are going out to do more energy efficiency projects, there will be more requirement for my staff to be involved.
Okay. And one last follow-up. Thank you. In the state energy efficient design and this bill, none of this would mandate that any one specific energy design protocol such as LEEDs would be used. It's the flexibility is there to use whatever fits the given situation. Is that correct?
Representative Dinkfelder, Representative Burley, that's absolutely correct. What SEED requires in the new buildings and major renovations is 20% better than existing code. And for existing buildings, currently we require state agencies to reduce their energy usage by 10%. This would raise that to 20%.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to make sure I understand this legislation. On page 3, on line 28, it says, before January 1st, 2009, an authorized state agency shall prepare a plan for meeting the requirements of subsection 4, which is above, and the plan must include a whole bunch of stuff. I'm going to have multiple questions, but my first one is, what if the plans are fiscally unattainable? Has there been discussion about that?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the plan would be one that would be developed by and through the agency. So,
I want to make sure I understand. I just want to be clear on this. And that's on a project by project basis.
Representative Dinkfelder, Representative Smith, when an agency would complete this plan. If you're an agency like, let's pick OUS, and they have many campuses, they would look at each campus, U of O, OSU, OIT, and they'll look at their energy use at 2000 compared to today. for example, and they'll see whether or not they're saving 20% energy. If they're not saving 20% energy, they'll first come up with a campus-wide plan, which would cover their entire agency. They're going to have new buildings that they built under the state energy efficient design that were 20% or better than code. So they're going to not look at those buildings. They're going to look at the buildings that use the most energy first. So each agency is going to kind of tailor their plan for their particular agency.
Can I follow up? Let's go to line 25 through 27. This is the implementation piece. Down below what I just read was the planning piece. It says, before June 30th, 2015, an authorized state agency shall reduce the amount of energy the authorized state agency uses in a facility by at least 20%. Help me understand this. I'm reading that as every facility.
Representative Dingfield and Representative Smith, as I mentioned earlier, we are working with the agencies to fix this definition on the facility by facility. They need to reduce the energy usage for their agency by 20% overall.
So you anticipate amendments coming in addressing that point I just raised?
Representative Dingfield and Representative Smith, yes.
Okay. And I think Vice Chair Burley answered my question. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Okay. I support the concept. I just want to make sure I understand what we're talking about. Thank you.
And one thing just to call when we see the, there'll be a referral to Ways and Means. What won't be in the Ways and Means statement will be the cost savings, which is my understanding, cost savings, I think you mentioned, is potentially up to $6 million a year. Savings on energy costs. That is not necessarily factored in the Ways and Means process. It will be the cost of the FTE to implement the program. It doesn't include the cost savings or potential cost savings to the state. Representative Burr.
Just a quick comment, Madam Chair. This might be an excellent opportunity for a cap and trade system between state agencies.
Yeah. I think it's been said here first by Representative Girardi supporting cap and trade. So with that, I would thank both of you very much. I know that if you'd maybe like to stay up in case there's other questions or we call up the other folks, that would be helpful. Thank you so much, Representative Whitt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
And actually, I'd like to call up Bob Simonkin. Thank you, from the Oregon University System, because you've already been mentioned, so maybe you can help the committee visualize how this process would work. And I think it's always easier when we have an example that we can work through.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Simonson. I'm the Assistant Vice Chancellor for Capital Programs for the Oregon University System. And Betty did bring up several of, and members also brought up several of my concerns with the bill. And that is the definition of facility. If we'd have to go into each building and create a 20% reduction plan, that would be a monumental task. Because OUS, we're the stewards of over half of all the state buildings. And that translates to over 1,105 individual buildings. So to create an individual plan, that would be quite a task. I think we would rather focus on our top 10, 20 energy hogs and focus on those buildings instead. The second challenge we would face with this bill is the fact that our campuses are growing each year. Somehow the language states that we have to maintain a 20% reduction over a baseline, but if our campus square footage is growing by 5% a year, that challenge, we'd have to save more than 20% to get the net savings. So those are our two challenges that we would face right off the bat. As far as meeting the deadline for 2015 for that goal, some of you may know that we have quite a large backlog of capital repair projects. It's a deferred maintenance. It's in the neighborhood of $640 million. Mainly as a result of having most of our buildings built within a small window of time. We built over half of our space within a 15-year period. between 1960 and 1975, and that was to meet the growing demand from all the baby boomers. So that sort of section, those buildings now are at the end of their useful life as far as the systems, the heating, the cooling, the plumbing. So those components do need replaced. But to do that all at once, we couldn't physically do it. We have to maintain the operations of those buildings in order to teach classes. We can't take half of our buildings offline in any given time, because we are at capacity at most of our campuses. So that's the challenges we face, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
I have a question, but we'll see if there's other questions first. Okay, can you tell me, so you're currently meeting this at 10%, is that correct?
I don't have that data from that. Where are we at?
Or how are you doing in meeting your 10% goals, maybe I should ask.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, the issue with meeting this goal, in 2000 the data was collected as the Oregon University System, and it wasn't. It was collected as a gross number. So when they report from 2000 to 2003, they actually increased their energy use by 35%. Well, this number isn't corrected for number of buildings or square footage or a reasonable metric for the university. That's why this bill says the Oregon Department of Energy shall establish by rule a method for determining this baseline. And we'll go back and adjust the baseline so that we can go to the Oregon University System and look at U of O or OSU and how many buildings they had and how many square feet, and we can actually compare apples to apples to see that they're making progress. Because they are going to grow. If we want to cap their energy usage at 2,000, I don't think they're going to be sitting up here supporting the bill.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you. Thanks for your input. We appreciate that.
Sure.
And we have a couple more people who'd like to testify. Actually, three more. And Betty, you can step down and then stay close by in case there's other questions, because obviously you have many of the answers to questions that we have. I have Joe Esmond from IBEW, Jeff Bissonette from Fair and Clean Energy, and Stephen Kapori, Johnson Control.
Madam Chair, do you want us together?
Yeah, sure, why not? There are three chairs up there. Joe, since you signed up first, have you come up?
Madam Chair, this is my first time here, so can I do guys go first?
You don't want to see how it's done from them.
I get the message.
I think you'll do fine. Thanks for coming here today. I appreciate it.
Good afternoon, one and all. I am Joe Esmond from the IBEW, Local 48 in Portland, Oregon, about 4,000 union electricians, statewide about 10,000. I come out and speak in favor of this. I am advisory council. I'm on the advisory board at the Energy Trust of Oregon, and I just got appointed to the city of Portland for new and old buildings for sustainable. So I just want to point out that I'm not a scientist, I'm an electrician by trade. There's more energy savings in retrofitting old buildings than you will get. You get it faster than putting up more windmills and solar, which we do. We have 650 people trained in solar. We're doing all the windmills. We just got approached by the city of Vail to do a solar wind and maybe geothermal. So we've been in the energy business for about 100 years. We had to train people to do the upgrade for controls, lighting, etc., etc. This morning's New York Times has some articles you might want to look at. The power, the price of power is going up 2% a year. I'd be willing to share it with you. It's easy to build a new green building. It's cool to have windmills. One of our contractors just was awarded the largest solar project in the Northwest. It'd be out there on Marine Drive in Portland. So I just want to speak in favor of this. There's a lot of things when you say a retrofit can be done very easily. We have one of our contractors who did stuff up at OHSG when you fly from the helicopter, you put a machine down there, and you can see all the energy loss. So we're for this bill. How'd I do?
Great. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Bissonnette.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition, a statewide collaboration of a variety of different public interest organizations, including consumer groups, environmental organizations, human service agencies, faith groups, clean energy businesses, and labor. Here to support House Bill 3612. We were strong supporters of the bill last session. We've appeared in front of some interim hearings on this concept. It's still a good idea. The cheapest kilowatt hour that you can get is the kilowatt hour you don't have to produce in the first place. And so the state has been making tremendous gains in clean energy, but again, the cleanest, again, is the kilowatt hour that isn't produced in the first place. This is one of those bills that is, a win-win-win all the way around in terms of, taxpayer savings, in terms of energy savings, in terms of environmental impact. We strongly encourage passage of the bill. We support a lot of the concepts for potential amendments to make it a better bill, and we will be working with various other stakeholders to make sure those amendments happen so that we can bring you back a bill that you can pass along to your Ways and Means colleagues with pride. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Why don't we hear from Mr. Corey first?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Gaffori. I've spoken to you before, so I'll be brief on this. I represent Johnson Controls, which is one of the providers that would be servicing this bill. We're a union shop, and I want to let you know. That's one of the nice things about this bill is that it does provide a lot of high-paid quality jobs, and I'm very excited about it. I want to just really briefly remind you of how an energy savings performance contract works. This is one of the tools in the toolbox in this bill. An energy savings performance contract done by our company, or there are a number of other companies, large and small, both in the state of Oregon, provide the same service. Does an analysis of a government agency's facilities, works with that agency's technical staff to define a mutually defined scope of work where both people have put the scope work together, which may contain a large number of different variables. There is a guarantee, which is the really good feature of this. The guarantee by the company is that if in any one year during the lifetime of that contract, the cost of that retrofit, including the financing, the design, engineering, and construction, is not totally covered by the savings, then the company will write a check back to the government agency for the difference. Now, the key here is that because the company is going to make that guarantee, they're very cautious and conservative in their estimates of how much energy can be saved. In reality, about 80% of our customers receive cash back. They make money, 25% to 30% back. So this is not just a savings. It's a way for state agencies to use, and you heard some of this from Parks, you heard this from OES, that these agencies have backlogs of deferred maintenance. This is a way to help get at that backlog of deferred maintenance, putting these projects together. I wanted to add some detail to Representative Cannon's question earlier about pre-qualification. The process now is long and complicated, and we've been working with the Department of Energy and Department of Justice to work out a pre-qualification plan where if people are pre-qualified, then an agency can hire somebody directly. And step by step, or one of the passes, or by pass, one of the steps, that right now you have to go through. This is a common practice in other areas. For example, agencies that do a lot of building and use architects will often have a list of pre-qualified architects, and sometimes what they'll do is just routinely go through that list, or they may say which architects on that list are particularly experienced and skilled in particular kinds of building design. So it's not a new concept to have a pre-qualified list and have agencies choose from that list. We're very supportive of that concept, and obviously we're supportive of the bill. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Bard?
Stephen, this bill was before the Environment Committee in 05-07. What happened?
Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, politics.
June.
I can tell you about it sometime later if you'd be interested.
Okay.
It did pass out of the committee and on the House floor.
No, this is 2005.
Oh, 2005. I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about last session. But the funding was the issue, really, last session.
2005.
Yes.
I just want to add on page 1, line 13 and 14, I think you forgot to mention wave energy. They project to have a wave farm off the coast of Reedsport within 18 months to 24 months. Oregon has some of the best waves in the world. OSU was working heavily with that, was other people. There's seven investment firms have filed for FERC permits off the coast of Oregon. So, if you want to throw in wave, yeah, we do that too.
Great, thank you. And Representative Cannon had a question.
Yeah, thanks. And Jeff, I'd be interested, sort of surprised we haven't heard more already about the gains that the state agencies have made in terms of meeting their requirement on the current 10% reduction. And then was sort of startled to hear that between 2000 and 2003, the university system actually increased their energy use by 35%. And there were probably lots of reasons for that, including, you know, expanding footprint, et cetera. But are you... do you have a sense of how well the state is doing under current law, and Steve, any of you, towards meeting these?
I think Betty might be able to answer that.
Meeting the current requirement to reduce energy consumption by 10%.
Yeah, and Betty Merrill from Department of Energy can offer some specifics. I think that you know, more and more there's a greater and greater awareness of the need to use energy more efficiently. And you know, I've been doing this work for about a decade, and I'm really still a new kid. In doing this, and you know, I tell you, a decade ago, energy and energy efficiency was it was pretty hard to get a conversation started about that, and so we're still in the early throes of this renewed interest, and so I think that the energy crisis of 2000 and 2001 really put it on the front burner for a lot of folks, particularly state agencies, and then since then it's been a renewed interest. There is already some effort on the part of the governor's office to try and, you know, bump the current 10% up to 20, but we thought that a message from the legislature was also an appropriate message to send, again, just to keep the attention and the focus on using the energy that we produce more efficiently so we don't have to build more power plants, et cetera. So in terms of specifics, I'd turn that over to Ben.
Come up and give us an update, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, in the last report, we indicated that 13 agencies currently met the 20%.
20%?
20%. The data that was collected in 2000 is electrical data only. It's electricity. So, as I said, we may have... we may have more agencies, we may have less agencies when we go back and adjust this baseline for number of square feet. But we believe agencies are making a real effort to get here.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Why I have you still up here. Can you turn to page 1 really quick? Section 1, page 1. Is there a reason that, I'll read this, it is the policy of the state of Oregon that facilities be constructed or purchased by authorized state agencies, be designed, da-da-da-da-da. Is there a reason why we don't have owned
in there, so it says owned, constructed, or purchased.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the reason that this was operated was that there are some state agencies that have facilities that are operated. An example would be an arena, potentially, that is built by someone else in a university, operates that facility, and is responsible for paying the energy bills of that facility. That's why it says operated.
To me, Madam Chair, it just seems like if we're going to advance this House bill forward and we're going to set a policy of the state of Oregon, it ought to be more inclusive than just those that are to be constructed or purchased. Second question. I'm concerned about the future of this bill. As an old Ways and Means person who served 6 years down in Ways and Means, I'm worried that back on page 3 and subsection 4, that we're just dooming this thing for failure because of the fiscal impact. Is there a way to, in the very short time we have, try and work immediately with the powers to be down in Ways and Means to find out how to make this fiscally attainable with between now and 2015? I don't understand. Help me understand. What am I missing here that the state of Oregon has the financial resources to achieve 20% efficiency, 10% greater than we are with the fiscal resources, the financial resource, excuse me, that we have? How do we do that? What am I missing?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, you ask a really, really good question, one that we started asking during last session, and we asked the Ways and Means Chairman about every 15 minutes since then till now, and between you and me, I haven't got an answer that I really can take home and say, here's why that bill didn't get through, here's what the specific concern is. I don't know. I don't think it's a concern about how much it's going to cost to do the retrofitting, because we're talking, that's free. In fact, you get money back from doing the retrofitting. That doesn't cost anything. I'm saying that it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen unless it's... If you had a building that's going to take more to retrofit than you're getting energy back, then this building requires you to do it. I think the issue has to do with the financing of the study. And who's going to pay for the study? And right now the bill says that the studies are done by the state agencies, but the energy department can build them back for that study. And that's not right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what the bill says is that you have to develop a plan. Who does the audits? Who does the audits would be a contract agency. We do oversight to make sure that the measures they've identified make sense in terms of energy payback, cost of systems. That's what our piece is, kind of an oversight piece. I think with Ways and Means, the concern here is truly a disbelief on the part that we can actually make this investment and it will pay off.
Let me inject really quick, because I want to see you succeed on this.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing about Ways and Means that's important to understand is that there's a timing issue of the money. And in order to make these improvements, the cash is going to go out immediately. So there's going to be a large injection of cash going out the door. Okay? Then the savings, I interpret, are going to occur on a month-to-month basis as your utility costs are reduced. Somehow you're going to have to work with Ways and Means to understand that they're going to have to inject cash up front over a period of time between now and 2015, and then over a longer period of time recoup that.
Madam Chair, Smith, that's not the problem. With all due respect, under an energy savings performance contract, you borrow the money. They won't be putting any money up. There will be no general fund involvement in this. In terms of the energy saving projects, she can tell you a lot more than I can about the details of the financing. there are state monies available right now, and there's agencies can go and get borrow money. It's not the financing of the facility that's the cost.
So the debt service on the financing is paid through the efficiencies
exactly
that are obtained.
That's guaranteed under energy savings.
The fiscal and Ways and Means is it's the reimbursement of the FTE for the Department of Energy, because the agencies are going to have to do the plans working with Department of Energy. And correct me if I'm wrong, Betty. That's what the funding is. It's not to pay up front for the cost savings that will be realized over the life of the buildings or whatever. It's to pay for the FTE.
Representative Dinkle, Representative Smith, that's exactly right. We don't have the authorization to hire additional staff to do the program, and that's the issue. The funding for my staff is fee-based. So
I don't want to take any more time right now. I would love for you to come visit with me, because I'm struggling with the fact of creating plans that are going to mandate action, and I'm struggling with the fact that's not going to cost money. And that's for Ways and Means, but I want you to succeed, and I think there's going to be 19 other people on there that are going to scratch their head on that question.
I will encourage you to visit with Representative Smith, and also just to let you know, we're working very closely with the governor's office and all the different agencies that would be affected by this bill to make sure that there's clear understanding and support as we move forward. Representative Blair, did you have another question?
Representative Smith covered my question.
Okay. Thank you. Great. Thank you so much. And with that, unless there are other questions, we are going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3612. Is there anyone else before I drop the gavel that would like to testify on this bill? Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3612. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 3611. Beth?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3611 is the bill that deals with the exemption time period for dentists that was adopted in Senate Bill 704 last session. What this bill does is expand the list of wastewater treatment facility types with whom dentists may work in order to be able to hold off until January 1st of 2011 on installing an amalgam separator. There is no subsequent referral on this bill, no revenue impact, and no fiscal impact. There is in your packet a dash one amendment to the bill, which we can talk about as I think we get to that issue.
Okay. So first up is I will invite Margie Hoffman and Beryl Fletcher from the Oregon Dental Association. And actually, we'll have Patrick come up also with the Board of Dentistry. So we'll have all three of you come up.
Chair Dinkfeld, members of the committee, my name is Margie Hoffman. I represent the Oregon Dental Association.
Chair Dinkfeld, and members of the committee, my name is Bill Fletcher, and I work for the Oregon Dental Association.
Chair, my name is Patrick. Forgive me, I have a horrible cold. My name is Patrick Bratson. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry.
We're going to work to get you another microphone so you don't have to all share one. Why don't you go ahead and start, or whoever would like to.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, ODA does support House Bill 3611 and the Dash 1 amendment. The amendment is necessary to allow the entity certifying dentists and BMPs to complete the certification process. Without the amendment, House Bill 3611 does not allow time for action by those wastewater agencies. Presented to you previously, and we've given you some additional materials and the PowerPoint presentation from that has been somewhat updated to facilitate today's meeting. BMPs do capture a larger portion of the amalgam waste, and that's why we would like to see the dentists certified in BMPs. The wastewater agencies themselves are very excited to be able to certify the dentists and the BMPs, because not only are we dealing with the amalgam waste, but we're also dealing with the lead and silver, which are other issues that the wastewater is needing to address. We also feel that this is a good opportunity to expand the cooperative efforts that we have with state and local agencies through BMP certification throughout the state. And so therefore we think it's an important part of the solution, which was the intent of Senate Bill 704. We went through the amalgam separator installation, some of the barriers before. I think we've talked about them, the insufficient space, the existing plumbing, the building permits that are necessary, you know, and some of the criteria that the dentists need to use and keep in mind when they're selecting their separator and doing those kinds of alterations to their buildings. But at this time, we would just ask that you would consider and support House Bill 3611 and the -1 amendment.
Do you want to say something about the amendments?
There's been some confusion over the dates and the purpose of the amendments. I just want to clarify for the record. Senate Bill 704 went into effect January 1st of this year and allowed dentists who are operating in an area where the wastewater manager is a special district to apply for certification to in following the best management practices. And then if they were to receive certification, the deadline for installing an amalgam separator was January 1, 2011. We came back at the beginning of this session because it turns out there are more wastewater management entities out there than just special districts. So we came up with umbrella terminology that would include all of the different wastewater management agencies and allow them to certify dentists who are following best management practices. There was a request that we come to a compromise regarding the deadline for installation. Let me go back. So we added the different entities who in this bill, and we extended the deadline for dentists to apply for certification till September 1st, 2008. So that's one of the dates that you see in the -1 amendments, and it's necessary. The bill has to go into effect immediately, and then dentists will have till September to apply for certification. The second date that you see is the deadline for amalgam separator installation. There was a request that the Oregon Dental Association work with a new stakeholder in this process to come to a compromise on the deadline for installation of separators. We did so, and we set the deadline for January 1st, 2010. So everybody is on board with this bill. Everybody supports House Bill 3611 and the adoption of the -1 amendments.
Great, thank you. Any questions, or would you like to add to that testimony?
Just that the board is supportive of both the bill and the -1 amendments.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Cannon.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Margie. Just to clarify, this looks like sort of a classic compromise where there were some folks saying, let's push up the date for requiring their installation to 2010, and then other folks said, well, okay, but if we're going to do that, we need more time to allow folks to become certified in order to qualify for that extended date rather than the immediate requirement to...
The reason that the date was set at Chair Dingfelder, Representative Cannon, I'm still learning how to testify. The reason that the date that the exemption was included is what we testified to in the hearing of the LC bill. So that there are dentists who operate in places where they need to undergo major construction, they need to rezone, they need to get permits. So that's why we said that dentists who apply for certification is following the best management practices, which reduces the mercury and, you know, mandates recycling of silver and lead, gets the bulk of the toxins out of the wastewater. If they're following that, then we give them a reasonable amount of time to install the separators. But what we ran into with Senate Bill 704 is that not all of the dentists who have those types of complications were able to receive certification because they are in places out that are not managed by special districts. So we just are asking, the exemption is so that dentists who need time have a reasonable timeline in order to install separators. After passage, hopefully this bill will pass, after that happens, they would have a year and a half to install separators, and we feel that's an adequate amount of time to undergo permitting processes and construction and different hurdles they may have to jump over.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up is Michael Mason from the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs, Willie Tiffany from the Oregon Cities, and Sandy Duffy. Why don't you go first?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities. We gave an expansive testimony 2 weeks ago when you introduced the legislative concept. We just wanted to make sure and put on the record we are still very supportive of the legislation, and it is, in fact, many of my members who offer or have these certification programs that are not qualified under the current bill to allow those dentists that participate in those certification programs to take advantage of the provisions of Senate Bill 704. So we have upwards of 25 members that do operate these types of programs, and this bill will allow those folks to participate in the program. So we are supportive, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I just have one. Have you seen the amendment?
Yes.
And are you supportive of the amendment?
We are supportive of the amendment, Madam Chair.
Mr. Mason.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the House Energy and Environment Committee. For the record, my name is Michael Mason. I represent the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon, and I'm glad to be here today. The tribes support the, of course, going back for a moment, this is originally Senate Bill 704 from last session. The tribes came to an accommodation with the Oregon Dental Association and other interested parties on this. We made this deal, and I think it was a good deal, except that there was a drafting problem. So we support the amendment, or the bill, I should say, and then we also support the Dash 1 amendments. Getting the separators in place sooner, we think, is worthwhile. All of the information that we've seen is that these separators capture 97% to 99% of the mercury that is going into dental drains, and that's very significant. And at the same time, you know, there's the ODA's interest in recycling the mercury. We think that's also significant. We're not in a position, we don't have the luxury at Warm Springs, certainly, of dispensing with mercury amalgam in dentistry. We absolutely just don't have the money to do it any other way. So or with the composite or gold or those alternatives. So we appreciate working with them and the other parties on coming up with a good compromise, and urge your vote for the Dash 1 amendments and do pass recommendation for the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, my name is Sandra Duffy. I am the board president for Consumers for Dental Choice. I am also representing the Oregon Center for Environmental Health here today. My testimony today and the submitted materials explain the importance of Senate Bill 704 and why this amendment, HB 3611, is necessary to make the law work as it was intended. Senate Bill 704 was a first small step in addressing mercury amalgam dental fillings as a significant source of ongoing mercury exposure. And for those legislators who embrace the precautionary principle, we urge you to look upstream to stop the flood of mercury into the environment from dental amalgams. This means using alternatives if they are available and banning mercury-added products, as you have done with thermometers, car switches, and other mercury-added products. I have prepared handouts that include Attachment 1, which is a copy of this original Senate Bill 704, Attachment 2, which is a copy of this Bill 3611, and Attachment 3 is a fact sheet for amalgam dental fillings, which contains statistical information about mercury dental fillings as a significant source of environmental pollution. This fact sheet was used in the 2007 legislative session to urge passage of Senate Bill 704. A few highlights are that mercury amalgam dental fillings are 50% elemental mercury. The average filling contains a half a gram of elemental mercury. This is the amount found in an old-fashioned thermometer. The average adult has 8 mercury fillings. In 1985, 3% of dentists were mercury-free. In 2007, 52% were mercury-free. We're moving in the right direction. Dental offices are the primary source of mercury in waste treatment plants.
Waste treatment plants do not treat amalgam, but it moves it into the mercury in amalgam, but moves it into the environment. By spreading treatment plant biosolids onto croplands, burying it, burning it, and discharging water effluent containing methylated mercury into waterways. Contra Costa County looked into the cost of treating the water coming out of a treatment plant and estimated it $190 per $1.90 per gallon to remove the mercury, and said that that would quadruple their entire budget. Attachment 4 is a pie chart graph that shows that in 2004, Dennis used 34 tons of mercury in amalgam fillings. Attachment 5 shows that there are 1,000 tons of mercury in all of the dental fillings in the mouths of all Americans. Oregon's share of that based on population is 11 tons. That's 22,000 pounds of mercury in the heads of Oregonians today. Most of that presently ends up in the environment. Attachment 6 reflects studies showing the percentage of mercury in wastewater treatment plants that originate from dental offices. It ranges up to 83%. And amalgam separator legislation has proven to be effective. In the city county of San Francisco, mercury levels dropped by 90% with the installation of separators. Norway, Sweden, and Denmark recently banned the use of mercury amalgam in their countries. And even if amalgam was banned tomorrow in the U.S., dentists would still be removing it for the next 20 to 40 years. The need for House Bill 3611, I'm not going to go through that. I think it's been well stated by everybody else. And Oregon Center for Environmental Health and Consumers for Dental Choice are in favor of going ahead and fixing that glitch with the certification as well as the timelines. There has been an important development since Senate Bill 704 was passed by the legislature last year. In October of 2007, the American Dental Association amended its amalgam handling best management practices to include the installation of amalgam separators. In your handouts, Attachment 8 is an article about that action by the ADA. It quotes the ADA's president, Mark Feldman, as saying, quote, dentists across the country have enthusiastically embraced ADA best management practices since we introduced them in 2003, end of quote. However, ODA has not added installation of amalgam separators into their BMPs. Thus, while ADA's voluntary BMPs include amalgam separators, at this time ODA's do not. And amalgam separators will only become mandatory if 3611 is passed on January 1st of 2010.
Ms. Duffy?
Yes.
We have to leave the room in 3 minutes, so I'm just going to ask you if you can wrap up so we would have time to move on to the work session.
Okay, I will.
Great.
There's still three outstanding problems with this bill, and it's because of compliance monitoring. First, there's no requirement for documentation of the manufacturer's verification that what was installed it does capture 95% of the amalgam, which is required by 704. Second, under 704, the compliance documentation is required to remain in dental offices until the Board of Dentistry asks for an inspection. This means that the public does not have the ability to find out if compliance is taking place or not. It's not in public custody, and they're not public documents. And third, environmental compliance is not a proper role for the Oregon Board of Dentistry. It is our position that DEQ is the proper government agency, and there could be a fee that would be assessed for the actual costs of that data keeping process. Thank you very much. I'm available for questions.
Thank you very much, Jeff. I appreciate it. And you have all the information in front of you, the addendum information that was referenced here. Are there any questions for the panelists here? Okay. Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3611 and open up a work session on House Bill 3611.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the H1 amendments dated February 4th, 2008.
Hey, Representative Cannon moves adoption of the H1 amendments to House Bill 3611. Is there any discussion? I would just like to say that I appreciate the work of all the parties that spent many hours to work through the amendment for this bill. I certainly appreciate your support in working together. Okay, with that, are there any objections to the amendment? The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3611 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cannon moves House Bill 3611 as amended with the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, just a note, I share the concern that our last presenter, Ms. Duffy, raised around compliance, and I think that's something we should continue to look at over the current interim, assuming this passes, and perhaps in 2009.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that, Representative Cannon, and one of the things we can do is ask ODA to come and make reports to us on how they're doing meeting those goals. I think that would be really helpful. Any other discussion? Okay. With that, I'm going to have the clerk call the roll.
Representative Fire.
Aye.
Representative Garrard.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Burley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cannon.
Aye.
Chair Dingfelder.
Aye. With that, the motion carries, and I will ask Representative Garrard, since you've been here for all the testimony, would you like to carry this bill to the floor?
I will, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we have a carrier. Representative Gorg will carry House Bill 3611 as amended to the floor. With that, I will close the work session for House Bill 3611. And before I drop the gavel, please check the agenda. For Thursday?
We currently don't have a meeting scheduled for Thursday, but we've been discussing it. Possibility of adding an informational session.
So please check the agenda for Thursday. There will not be a meeting tomorrow. No meeting tomorrow. Okay, with that, we'll close the House Energy and Environment Committee. Thank you for your attention.